So we're perfectly catching up with Yvonne Mackay here, who runs one of our other customer systems programs, if you will, and I'm just going to let her give her pitch now.
So we run the SQL Playback Program. So yep. The idea of the SQL Playback Program is customers can give us their SQL Server databases in a profiler trace of their workload, either production or test systems. We bring it into our lab, process it, and run it on the latest service packs and the latest builds of whatever we're developing. Check for performance regressions, check for functional issues, and hopefully by the time the customer gets hold of the build, they see no issues with it. So
if you get back to the question you were asking earlier on about the complexity of database systems and the applications, this is one of the great ways that we can replicate that, because we can do black box testing and white box testing, but that only tests, you know, the interaction between the components so far. And so what this allows us to do is to take a real customer workload that they really ran, as someone says, either in development or in production in many cases, and for us to rerun it here. And we can run it, you know, so we can stress, we can check for performance, we can check for behavior, and really it's a huge criteria for us that before we send out a service pack or even a beta, that these things all pass within certain limits. Yeah. How many playbacks did we have for SQL 2000?
For SQL 2000, I think we're probably around about 50 or so playbacks. Now, currently, our pools are...
What's a playback?
So the playback is the database and the SQL Server, the profiler trace file. So okay. Those together, we call a playback. So now we have about 250 total in our program, ranging in size from a few meg right up to 200, 300 gigs worth of data, to try and give us a good range of playback sizes.
Now we're going to go visit Yvonne's lab.
Hey.
There's a recurring theme here, SQL Server's lab-heavy organization.
Yeah, I noticed. It's more hard to learn in this building than in most others.
Lots of old hardware, lots of new hardware, rack mounted hopefully. We have a whole load of client machines which we actually support other teams doing international testing of international OSs and international SQL servers on these ones. 64-bit machines as well as 32-bit machines.
Yep.
I think down here we've actually got a playback running. Profiler in the background, we have a lot of automation around about it. This one's actually finished with a good big issue. And you can see this one, it took 23 hours to actually run through this little bit. So. And you see 250 playbacks takes a lot of machines.
Yeah. So that one test was running on all these machines?
No, one test only runs on one machine.
Okay.
That we span out. We need a lot of storage as well, so this is actually just pure storage for us. I think we've got a couple of terabytes worth of storage here for running the tests. We've got other, I think nearly 6 terabytes worth of storage just to hold the playback data. We actually share the lab with the integration team, so this is some of the integration hardware that we use our lab for.
It's impressive.
One of the things we're doing with SQL Server 2005 is extending the playback program to some of our other servers. So historically in SQL 7 and 2000, it was just SQL Server that we did this with, but we're adding support for analysis services in this release, so we'll be able to rerun their loads, and then we'll continue to add the other server products that we have in the SQL Server building as part of the product suite to this kind of approach, because it's proved to be so successful for us to validate things. Although the developers hate getting the bugs because they're notoriously difficult to fix, just like the real world. You know, if the state's been, the machine's been running for 23 hours like this one, and you just hit a performance problem at the end, or you hit an assert or something at the end, you have 23 hours worth of state on an NPROC machine with X amount of memory to go and try and work out what happened. And that's why the program's very, very effective.
What's the most interesting test you've seen? Or failure? Or
We actually do a lot of testing of other components as well. So we'll take the database tuning advisor, or we'll do some SMO testing. That can produce some interesting test cases that we expect the other core teams to pop that they haven't popped, or even just some install issues. The way that customers are using stuff, it installs, we install it with their default collation and what they're using, and we sometimes see some interesting cases of that, especially with international playbacks in terms of that.
Cool.
All right. Thanks,
Yvonne. Thank you very
much. We're going to pause now. We have a very boring walk, please.
Okay.
Okay. So we're... So we're still on the third floor. We just finished the customer labs, and we're now going to see part two of the Rogues Gallery. And so another bunch of the MVPs, many well-known. Kim Tripp, who invariably wins a prize at one of the tech eds for one of the best presentations.
Yeah. That's some of these people.
And the infamous Dr. Tom Moreau, one of our Canadian MVPs.
Great.
Right. You might want to kill it again while we wander around aimlessly trying to find Sonar's office.
Okay.
No, I think it might be over in this corridor.
Cool. Let me just cancel you here.
All right. Okay. We're now in the depths of the SQL Server Engine team. You've met some of the customer teams, the BI teams. This is Sonar Turek, who is the dev manager for SQL Server Engine, and Emma Van Allman, who is the test manager for SQL Server Engine. And everybody getting all excited about something to do with SQL Server Engine. It's great. Buy lots of it.
Yeah. That's the summary, I guess.
I don't even know where to start. What's the engine written in?
Oh, it is C++.
C++?
C++. It's many lines of code. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You guys have an excellent test framework. Some interesting numbers, actually, would be amazing how many.
We have over 250,000 tests, which we can run roughly twice a week, full runs.
Did you say quarter million?
Quarter million. Automated, no manual. It can be done twice a week, x86, IE64, AMD64. If we had to go full all out, we can do it. Now, it doesn't mean you can add any more to your test when you're doing that, but it's not bad.
I think Robert's struggling to comprehend that number. And remember, well, that's just SQL Server Engine. There are multiple other products in the box who have probably another 100,000, 200,000 tests between them.
Right. What?
You're wondering how did you manage that, huh?
The infamous Robert Scoble, lost for words.
I don't know.
For
yeah.
The first time.
Oh, it's not the first time. I get stumped all the time. I'm just trying to comprehend what the engine is. When you get
that's
a new
really
developer in here, what is it?
You don't have any UI, and there's just like layers of code that do something to the hard drive, right?
Pretty boring, actually. You could say that. Yeah. It's not something you can write mom about.
Yeah.
That certainly is the case. One thing that is exciting for all of us is it runs on really, really different platforms in terms of, well, it runs on this.
Yep.
And
it runs on all that big iron hardware we just saw.
Yeah, I don't know how many irons.
This is a fairly small iron. We can go visit the super room if we want later. We were just in the customer lab, which I think is a 16-way or a 32-way is the biggest thing that Karina has in there.
32-way.
Yeah, we've got some impressive boxes upstairs. If we have the time, maybe we can go upstairs and I can show you guys the boxes. So it may be interesting to see that.
See, the thing I find interesting about it, and this is most telling, is when you think about Microsoft right now, what is Microsoft running on? So your paycheck is running on this product right now.
And I do get paid every 2 weeks, so I guess
that's
it works.
That's pretty good. You go out to the HR website, you're being covered by this product right now. And the product doesn't work, that's usually the biggest thing you got to worry about, right? So if the product doesn't work, who do you affect? Well, you affect the airlines. You affect NASDAQ. You affect Korea, you affect countries, and that's kind of the other side. So it's this engine which is everywhere, and people are now dependent upon it all over the place to store their data.
If you guys could rewrite the engine from scratch, what would you do?
Oh, please.
I'd love to hear this one.
I am not sure I want to go a lot deeper into that. We would rewrite the engine. I still would not start with Java. But I would make it a lot more pipelined, most probably. It is currently big. That in itself is a management challenge. Well, keeps me employed. That's one way of looking at it. But seriously, there are lots of re-engineering efforts that we always look into. We don't let things go stale for a long time anyhow. So there's no such thing as, we will completely rewrite it from now. We write and rewrite portions of it all the time anyhow. That's how we keep it young and fresh.
How do you know which parts to rewrite?
It becomes pretty obvious when these guys start to pop a bug, like for every 3 tests they write, if they can pop a bug in one area, it's like, means that that part is getting old. We, of course, make sure that it becomes robust before we ship it, but we know that for the next one, we probably should not keep that guy and look deeply into it to see how we can make it a lot more robust, a lot simpler, so that it is a lot smaller engineering problem.
I would imagine you're doing a lot of performance measurements, right? And that'll tell you parts where you need to spend the engineering time.
Absolutely. So my group also does performance testing. So some of the boxes upstairs are actually purely around performance testing. And we do have some major boxes, like 64-way boxes with 1 terabyte of RAM, not disk.
Yeah,
terabyte of RAM, and we actually run on those.
Can I take that home with me today? Well, the media center would run real well on that.
Makes a great Doom server. Yeah. You get a lot of people playing Doom on a network.
If you got a jacket, we could go upstairs, but it is cold in there. I can tell you that. There are lots of disks, and so we do run many performance tests. We actually run them continuously, just like the 200, like quarter million test cases we have. We do have additional performance tests that we run all the time and measure the performance of the system and try to improve it all the time.
If you had a kernel developer from a competitor in here, what would you be bragging about? Or beers, you know? What would you say, ha, my engine does?
I would brag more about the engineering excellence that we are trying to achieve here, because that is more of a common ground. And in a way, I can brag about, hey, this engine does this, and if he's not writing another database server, why does he care? But in software engineering, for managing teams of this size, we all do have very similar problems. How do you control people writing stuff without the management knowing it? How do you make sure that the features really get finished with all the pieces being complete? How do you make sure that actually features get tested before they're checked in? And I think we, in the last several years, let's call it that way, we've been getting better and better in that engineering aspect of it, so that we build much nicer, much higher quality systems here. That's what I would brag about.
I also think that our own comfort in the product, like we have a lot more, we want to make sure the product's right before other people consume it. And so we put a lot of work up front to make sure it's done right. So that engineering practice, that dance between dev and test to create a product which, you know, is testable, is actually tested for the most part everywhere before it's actually checked in. That's something which on way back, call it 10 years ago at Microsoft, it used to be develop it and throw it over the wall to the test team. And now it's develop it and test it, and then put it in, and for the most part, you can consume it almost immediately after that. And that's a rarity.
Yeah. I actually would add, if I were to brag about something, I would add a new thing that we've been trying to do here is, you probably know about Watson, and we get these dumps from Watson. One of the problems with Watson is, do you have enough data in the dump? It is always a problem. And well, when you're running on a 1 terabyte RAM machine, getting a full dump is really completely out of the question. So you can't really dump all the memory and ask the customer to upload it over the internet to us. So since that is the case, we've been trying to figure out ways of understanding what portions of the memory we need in order to debug an issue. And that's a hugely important thing for us. So in order to excel in that, what we have instituted internally is we create the same Watson dumps internally for our test passes before the product is long before it is released. We internally, we use the same things.
And how we basically are trying to create a behavior of collecting the right dumps, the right information.
Yes. Yeah.
So let me.
Because you can't dump just a terabyte of RAM onto a hard drive.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I'll tell you how it kind of evolved. So we, as typically when you file a bug, which is caused by either an assert or an AV, the product automatically gives us a dump. We have two types. We have these big dumps, which are huge, and you'd never want to be able to ship them across the internet. And then we have these mini dumps, which for the most part, you could never find out what the problem was. So what we did is the mini dumps became better, and we needed a process and behavior that would keep improving them. So we never really got to the point of the full dump. At the same time, the testing, which has to make these runs, massive runs, can automatically file bugs on an AV or an assert. And we don't even have to look at those things. They just automatically, if it goes off, this mini dump, which is now a much more intelligent dump, is automatically filed into Product Studio. And then the behavior, which is kind of interesting, is we'll also file the big dump, and we'll sometimes file even the steps that may have caused it. But you don't get access to that magic unless you had to redirect yourself to get to it. And then if you redirected yourself to get to it, you got to file a bug against yourself for why you had to go there. So you want to take it from there?
Yeah. So basically the idea is to keep improving the mini dumps so that they contain the right information all the time. So the process of, so we kind of audit who needed to access the full dump or even the repro steps, which are not things that we can have available to us if the Watson is coming from a real customer. We want to turn it around and make it into a bug for the mini dump so that next time around, this will be an issue that, or similar issues will be something that can be resolved by just looking at the information that is available in the mini dump. And we actually even jump-started this process. The hardest part of this is, how do you start? What do you do? We said that, we don't know what to do. That's just the truth. We don't know where to start, how much to put on it, how much is too much, how much is too little. So we made an executive decision after a lot of scientific research. We said that every little dev team will devote 5 developer days, basically assign a developer for a week, to come up with what they will put in their own portion of the mini-dump, what they think they need in order to debug problems within their component. And we jump-started the process that way, and we keep improving the process since then. And it is really amazing the improvement we have seen. We started with 40% or something like that, less than 40%, which is basically the percentages, how many of the mini-dumps, just the mini-dump, can lead us to the understanding of the problem with the solution to it. And we are hovering over 70-80%, or 80%.
We started the usage of this on our stress beds. Typically, they would crash for an assert, and that's where we would just be generating automatic files. And then we moved it to the functional runs and expanded it across all 250,000 tests. That was amazing because you can still debug the problems even on the functional runs for those class of failures. Now, we could take the next step where if we get Watson grabbing stuff for other things other than asserts and AVs, we'd be really there.
We're working on that. And another thing about this is there's a huge cultural aspect to this because you ask a developer, there are different shifts in a developer mentality. Some wouldn't even, or not in my group anymore, normally would not even talk to you unless you actually repro the problem and put it on their debugger, have all the symbols ready in there, ready for Mr. whoever to debug. Well, that's not the real world. The real world is some problem comes out of thin air in a lot of the cases, so there's a big cultural shift. People not only debugging from repro scenarios on a live server, going down to debugging from a dump. Well, by the way, it's not even a full dump. And if you didn't get all the information, you have to go back and file a bug against yourself so that next time similar problems can be resolved. I think that has been a very successful thing for us. I think we've been getting...
It's amazing what the company's learning from the crash dumps and the Watson data. I hear that not just in this team, but other teams as well. What else do I want to know about the... How is the engine?
That's right.
I'm a Windows guy. How has it changed over the last 10 years? What's the biggest trend that you've seen in database engine development?
Well, it's not that easy for us to comment too much on it because we are both on it for about 4.5 years.
Right, but if you were to say, what's the evolution
from
the type of data that was stored, and you said originally it was relational data, lots of tables, and then it's evolving now to the other extreme of being a good place to store your unstructured data, your stream data, as well as your semi-structured data. So it is becoming a platform that can grab all of that.
And I think I want to add to it that it grew from something that was, in a way, perceived as a departmental database server to an enterprise-critical database server. If you look into WinterCorp's report out of the biggest OLTP databases, out of the 10, I think we have 2 or 3 of the biggest OLTP databases in the world. I believe that is the...
What's right? OLTP? Online
transaction processing. It's the typical cases like check caching and stuff like that. Yeah.
We talked about different workloads a little earlier on where I talked about the volume of transactions that would come out of something like AT&T's call records or something like that. And then we talked about how to make something meaningful out of that using business intelligence, right? So there's multiple workloads in the database industry, and really the WinterCorp measures OLTP, which is the day-to-day business. The BI or the DSS workloads are then, how do I really get insight into my organization? How do I make business decisions faster, better, more effectively based on that data? Because as we said earlier, if you have these terabytes of data we're talking about, you've got to crank with it. You've got to do something with it to be able to report, analyze, and do things like that. And that's what Mike Blazek was talking about earlier on, about how to leverage that data once it's in the system. So the way to think about it is, these guys make sure the data scales, secure, you get paid on time, your HR web is up, and all sorts of things like that. The guys we talked to earlier allow you to do nice business decisions based on that data.
Yeah.
Don't you think the engine's also expanding? Like, when you always think of it as a core, and we start saying, you know, previously, if you wanted to expand what the engine does for you, you really had to write more C code and stick it right into the engine. This now we are partnering with the CLR team, which basically allows us to add or script and extend what the server is. That's actually really huge. As far as seeing what applications are actually built with it at this point, we actually really haven't seen that many, but hopefully we will very soon.
Yeah. Well, you haven't released yet, have you?
No.
We had one customer in the lab who had a T-SQL function that was rewritten. It was a financial calculation. And I think one of the program managers rewrote it on the spot without too much thinking or design or anything else like that. And it was 40 times faster in C# than T-SQL.
Wow.
Which is not surprising. T-SQL is not your, hey, let's do a lot of computation kind of programming language. It is a data retrieval, data management language, and therefore it pretty much not is a very ideal tool to write financial calculations. So when you convert it to C#, so the extensibility that Edmund is talking about is very, very important. So that's another area that we grew into. And of course, at the same time, enterprise level features like getting mirrors of your database at the lowest level, or service broker, or stuff like that. So in the last 10 years, I could say that the engine apparently matured and grew into a much bigger enterprise quality system. That is still the ease of use champion among all the top 3. So, which is, I believe, is something really cool and we should all be proud of.
Yeah.